Of course, the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is a podcast dedicated to practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, called practical politics because it is all non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is always rule-based politics, every 2 years, every 4 years. It's basically what you do at the voting booth. And then there is full-spectrum practical politics, or engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the rules, but never breaking the rules. But to do anything, we have to start with practical politics, and in this case, it's the art of staying on message. It's having a consistent message. And our consistent message is a mantra, or white rabbit genocide you see on this front page. And we will also, in this podcast, engage in the geopolitical. We will talk about geopolitical events. We will talk about things from a unique white rabbit perspective. We will also go into white rabbit psychology and ecology and talk about everything you'd want to know about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And this is, again, the Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. Hello to all new listeners out there. I know I've got plenty of new people who are tuning into this podcast because the website traffic is up tremendously and all that's wonderful. But the one thing you need to understand is white rabbit genocide and everything the New World Order is based on. White rabbit genocide. Yeah, so you're in the right place to find out everything you want to know from a legitimate white rabbit perspective. In this particular podcast, this is an ongoing conversation. In this particular talk, I'm going to go over news and views, and I'm going to talk about some current news. Right now, we are in the end game. We're at the between the quarter and the halfway point before all hell breaks loose in World War III. We are cruising into World War III. The moves players are making are big and broad, and we're going to go over them and within the context of everything we've already talked about, using the language that I use and all that other wonderful stuff. But let's start cruising over some news and views, and I'm going to bounce around some different news and add my input on what's going on. You're going to see more and more headlines like this one from the Mail Online, and this is typical Anglosphere type stuff. The social engineering schools in Anglosphere, the New World Order is basically based on some type of global rationing. And you're going to see all kinds of scare stuff in regarding the environment, and it's going to get more and more. Meteors are going to hit us. Asteroids are going to hit us. Anything to scare the hell out of rabbits. Get ready for global Katrina. Biggest ever solar storm could cause power cuts which last for months. Well, something can always happen. It's happened before. Things can happen again. But you're going to see more and more type scare pieces like this. And of course, this is you know, Al Gore. Al Gore is a famous American. He's a vice president, and he runs around talking about all this stuff. Why he is not a linked to the Pink Rabbit banksters, only indirectly, he is linked to the Pink Rabbit elitesters. He's one of their talking heads, and that's how they operate. And in this particular podcast, too, I'm going to go into some news on the Pink Rabbit Elitesters. I'm going to talk about a split in the ranks. I'm going to talk about what we've been talking about, that there's an apparent split. But let's cruise on through here. Muslim Brotherhood's moderate father figure, Yusuf al-Qaradawi. And he's the one that called for all Jews to die, and he would like to shoot them from his wheelchair. And he's, of course, head of the Muslim Brotherhood. There's been talk that the Israelis are going to talk with him directly or something like that because they're really worried about Egypt. Egypt, of course, Hosni Mubarak has been thrown down, and you can read an interesting piece on him on the American Thinker. And there's a lot of controversy on him. On one end of the equation, we have all these big riots happening, all these big so-called revolutions. In America, of course, we have, you've noticed the different Midwest states, and they're gathering at the Capitol, and there'll be more and more of that over the next 90 days. In fact, there's going to be a tremendous amount of it. It's going to be deafening, the type of racket they make. The particular marches you're seeing in America, the sponsors, they have corporate sponsors, were all put together in 2008, but this stuff has been planned for long, long before. The Pink Rabbits are under their plan, Operation Big Bamboozle. And it has a wide mix of environmental type stuff like that global Katrina scare and different so-called revolutionary marches and rallies and all these different groups from unions to the whole entire Pink Rabbit apparatus, the Red Hippopotamus apparatus is making its stand in Middle Earth. as we'll call it. And this is all stuff leading up to the war. It will come to a crescendo, and there'll be a catalyst point. And into that catalyst point, they're going to hit some hocus pocus. They're going to hit some pink... The red hippopotamus has... Well, if he's real, you're going to meet him. But the pink rabbits have them some hocus pocus, and they're going to pull some stuff. They're tuning up their engines. They're tuning up their engines in Egypt. They're tuning it up across the board. But into this, there's going to be a big crescendo, and in that crescendo, that's where you're probably going to get a little freaked out. They're going to do something interesting. I don't know exactly, but I have some ideals. It's going to be so out there. I don't even want to put it on here, but you'll know it at the moment. Because you'll be kind of terrified, but that should be some crescendo right before the war. And then definitely we're always looking right after the war. But World War III is a go. We've had, let's talk about this piece on Asian Times. Iran hopes for Egypt in new orbit. And it talks about Iran and talks about different connections in Iran and between Iran and Egypt. I'll post this for you guys to read. Something interesting piece about Egypt. Let me skip back. Zawi Hawass made a famous statement I was talking about in the previous podcast, and we've talked all about Zawi Hawass, all about King Tut, all about questions in White Rabbit history, Babylon and Egypt. But in Egypt, Zawi Hawass has been implicated in a broad museum looting with the Israeli Mossad. And I will put up a translated piece from, I want to say, some Arab news service. And, I can't even, an Arabic site, www.alawafd.org. And the conclusion from it is our alternative news and researcher here, Dr. Joseph Farrell, has actually caught on to this piece too that's been bouncing around. And it was published on sot.net, that's S-O-T-T.net, this translated of this Arabic broadcaster talking about Zawi Hawass hijacking... different Egyptian antiquities going way back. This is nothing new, and the Mossad being involved. And of course, if we know anything about the Pink Rabbit sphere, which is the Anglosphere, you've got the bankster clans, Rockefeller and Rothschild, and they're heavily connected in Israel, Washington, London, New York, Tel Aviv, and whenever they have dirty work to do, generally the little Jew rabbits get the bill. It doesn't matter if it was a czar to be murdered or whatever. But Dr. Joseph Farrell makes an interesting comment. He lists 5 points having to do with this, and I can't say it any better, so I'll post his little piece and I'll give the actual quotes. But this goes into what we've been talking about. I find the piece very interesting. The article seems to focus on a number of things. One, the creation of a vast fraudulent antiquities project requiring large funding that resulted in nothing. 2, covert DNA testing on mummies with preconceived results that are rejected by some Egyptians involved. 3, the theft of antiquities seems to have an ongoing affair under Hawass's reign as Egypt's antiquities are. 4, there appears to be a covert American and predictably enough Israeli involvement behind these operations. And Israel's right there. I mean, Israel's right there, so they're going to be involved. Or Mossad's going to be involved on some level. Number five, previous attempts to bring the pattern of antiquity thefts were stonewalled by Hawass. All these allegations are disturbing, to say the least, but they do also tend to confirm, if indeed they are true, that the suspicions of many in the alternative research community that someone peculiar and very suspicious has been going on in Egyptian antiquity since the reign of Hawass, and more recently, the building of the wall around the Giza compound. This is a story definitely worth watching, and I'll post the actual piece. You can read the translated piece from the Arab news sources. But that's an interesting piece, an update on the Egyptian looting. They believe that he's been implicated going way back, and he's up to something. The pink rabbits are up to something, the big bamboozle. And we know that the question in the Jewish history, of course, would be the Hyksos. And the Jewish elites are, of course, the premier pink rabbit. Pink rabbit banksters are Rockefeller and Rothschild, and then, you know, it goes on down the chain. And, of course, we have the big event in Libya, but let's talk about something that happened right before it or during, or right before the big event. We all focus on Libya. Iran is celebrating Mubarak's downfall with Suez Crossing. You have Iran pushing military ships through the Suez Canal, and the Suez Canal is controlled by Egypt. And Egypt, of course, is just went through a revelation. Actually, it was a revelation, finding out who runs our country, but a revolution. the revelation they probably knew about quite some time before. And let's talk a little bit about Libya and Libya's connection to all this, because there is a connection. Let me point out the obvious one in regards to Libya. Libya is, of course, right next to Egypt. We just had a so-called revolution in Egypt. I don't know exactly what happened there. I don't know if certain sides are, I don't know the whole deal other than it's not accidental, is what I'm saying. It's not accidental that you have all this happening right now in the end game. As we prepare to war, different parties are going to be making moves, and it's somewhat the fog of the end game, but the fog is going to start lifting. And as the fog lifts, we're going to see an internal split between Team Pink Rabbit elitesters and banksters. But when it comes to Egypt, something happened there in Egypt that maybe unnerved some people. Then we have Libya blowing up, and Libya is, of course, on this side of Egypt. So if you have to put troops in Egypt, or if you have to put troops behind Israel to support Israel, well, what are you going to do? Well, in Libya, you create a problem. Problems get reactions. Reactions get solutions. And let's face it, Gaddafi's kind of crazy. So do I think that's the case? I've been asked that. I don't know. It makes sense to me if something happened in Egypt they didn't expect, if they don't have control. The general that's controlling Egypt right now, I would assume that they have control of him, Pink Rabbits. Maybe not, though. We don't know a lot about this. The Muslim Brotherhood has been infiltrated nine ways a Sunday by different intelligence services. But that doesn't mean they haven't been infiltrated by Hezbollah itself. And Hezbollah is very difficult to infiltrate beyond the basic infiltration. You know, no one can crack them, it seems like. So we really don't know, but I will point out the obvious on Libya. Libya came into the war on terror after September 11, 2001. You remember there was a lot of dissension between the Anglo elites and the Western elites and Colonel Gaddafi. The Europeans don't like him at all. In fact, I think they may be down as, behind his downfall, but the Anglo elites and whatnot are have pretty much opened the door for Muammar Gaddafi after September 11, 2001. And after they did that, they brought him into the war on terror, and I want to say it's Tony Blair's historic speech in 2003, 2004, but they got back into the game, and Gaddafi's kind of accepted now. But Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, is educated at the London School of Economics. He has a PhD, and the guy's been on TV giving more Masonic hand signals than I've ever seen any one person give in the history in my life, really, over a short period of time. And then I'll put up some news pieces about it. Who is Muammar Gaddafi's family tree? And they talk about his son and his PhD from London School of Economics. Gaddafi heir, who inevitably is a friend of Andy and Mandy. They're talking about Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif, the one that's always shown on TV doing the Masonic hand signals. Yeah. He has a friend with Prince Andrew and Peter Mendelssohn, and friends all over London, basically. And, of course, his girlfriend is interesting because his girlfriend is Orly Wienermann, who I don't know if I pronounced it in the Jewish spelling, but she's an Israeli actress. She is blonde hair, green eyes. I'll put up a picture of her. But you're getting into Pink Rabbit bankster lines and things we don't know. And of course, Gaddafi's next move, sabotage oil and sow chaos, I believe they'll probably nip that in the butt. But what you're getting into is all the games between that have historically happened between the, well, let's call it the Israelis, Team Pink Rabbit, that we think they're all on different pages. It was kind of obvious that Hosni Mubarak was on the same page as Israel. It's kind of obvious. It's kind of obvious to any Arab to have a brain. But what they don't realize, and Hezbollah does, and the Muslim Brotherhood does, and many of the Arab street are finding out, is that the Saudis, there's a deal between the Saudis as well. The Gaddafis can come in and out of this deal, and the link is most likely some type of genetic link, and we've talked about that before. We've talked about something that we didn't see, that the Germans have alluded to, and that's, you know, one-third of the Middle East being genetically related to Neanderthals or something. But to control this group, there has to be a genetic tie. There has to be something we don't see. And Gaddafi's heir, Saif, of course, it comes out, and I don't know a lot about this kid's mother. His mother may have been Jewish. What you see is what you get Jewish. But when you get into this, what's the relationship? How do they run this game? Saudis and everything else, well, they wage war by deception, by and large. They have the elites. They don't really care who runs the countries. They care who runs the elites. And these elites have come under a great deal of pressure, Gaddafi being one of them. Now, of course, the question is, why is Obama being so hard on Gaddafi? Why is Obama supporting the overthrow of the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak, but yet only giving lip service to certain revolutions in Iran. Well, they're, in my opinion, they're giving a little more lip service, but I think there's something to be said here. There's a historic split that went on, and this historic split came with the election of Talibama. I was asked a very direct question by someone who has listened very closely to this podcast. In the early part of this podcast, I told my listeners, and I'm talking about in the first handful, that Obama's not owned by who you think he's owned by. You see, there are two sides of this equation. There are pink rabbit banksters. Your little Jew rabbits basically serve them. The orders come down from the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, Masonic fraternities. Masonic fraternities are all linked to London. They're all linked to Her Majesty. And then there's elitesters. Elitesters always usually have a link to royalty. Historically, this doesn't matter. This doesn't matter because they run their game. When the Habsburgs, let's go back in the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs let the little werewolves run around and collect taxes and harass us, white rabbits and everything else, the little Jew rabbits. They obviously have a deal. One thing that was pointed out to me, there was a time in my existence I was big on news and Jews, as Bob's calls it. I was obsessed with the Jews because as soon as we realize something's wrong, we look for the player doing a lot of the dirty work. And it sticks out like a sore thumb. You don't believe me? Go over to incogmag.net. They jump out at you. Read David Duke's Jewish Supremacism. The Jews will jump out at you in the equation. And in this particular day, I was reading an article, and this comes up in America all the time. There was a general in America saying, and on this particular day, I was reading this article about this particular general in America, and I can't remember his name, but this is not uncommon over the last 50 years. And he said, they let these Jews, these Israelis, get whatever they want, do whatever they want. Now, the question is, and I was going on and on about this, and someone sat over top of me, and this is what Bob will do generally, and say, who's they? Who's they? Who's the they that's letting them? You know, we always look at the Jews, but we don't realize there's a they that's letting them. We always look at the Jews running around collecting taxes for the Habsburg, but we don't understand that they have a historic agreement that goes way back with this group. Way back. But the theys are the elitesters, and the theys are very real. And the theys apparently don't like us because over the last 50 years they've agreed to wipe out the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. You know, the emperor of China may kill some Chinese, but you're not going to make a move on all of China. That's a pretty bold move. But they're going for their new world order and they're part of their crew. Now, what's up with the elitesters? I'll get back with that at the end. But if they have a historic agreement, let me put it to you like this. And if they have a historic agreement that goes way back, but it's time to break that off, and they don't like the bankster clans or the elitester clans. Elitester clans don't like the bankster clans, or they want to get rid of the Jews, or so on and so forth. The agreement, who runs America doesn't really mean anything because they're not American. But who runs America doesn't mean anything if the Jews control both sides. If the banksters out of London, Rockefeller and Rothschild, Rockefeller's is a big deal in America. If they're running both sides. If they're running both sides of the equation, it does not mean a whole lot, right? It doesn't mean a whole lot. The Habsburgs got it in with the Rothschilds and they're running their game. It doesn't really matter who gets elected. On the other hand, if there's a split, if the Habsburgs are splitting from the Rothschilds, if it's time for the split, if they've been peeled off, if they got offered a deal, if they're stuck in Teutoburg Forest scared to death, and Arminius comes and offers the elitesters a deal, and they sell out, well then who gets elected in America means something. Then you're going to see something crazy like Rothschild throw a an actual dinner party for John McCain. That means something. That means something. American elections typically, you know, it only means something if someone's been really over the top sold out. In other words, if they control both sides of the equation, there's nothing to worry about. But Talibama is not owned by the banksters, in my opinion. Talibama is owned by the elitesters. And it has to do with who his mama is related to. And all these guys, every time I turn around, they're always related. And they're always related to something distinct. To answer my Asian listeners, and Asians are way more up to date on the Bushes, the Harrimans, the Gores, and other, we don't know enough about Indo-European genealogy. We know what we're told, and we're a very tight gene pool. But if I were to tell my listeners that the elitesters make up 80% of the time we've been betrayed, that the elitesters make up this group, and they all are related on one certain level, and that goes to maternal lines, ancient maternal lines, well, that'd be an eye-opener. We got our traitors nailed down. And as we sit across the top of this planet, as the iron question comes out, are you pro-white or are you pro-white genocide? The elitesters, well, they become more and more isolated with us. more, and you're going to see stuff like this. But this historic split, in my opinion, this is somewhat speculative, but I think history will write it, that Obama was peeled off. Because Obama, although he was supported by a lot of Jews, I think Rothschild sent the message very clearly. If there's a split ongoing between the Habsburgs and the Rothschilds, and he's backed by the Habsburgs, let me put it in, you know, stark European language, if Rothschild doesn't get his boy elected, you could see big trouble in the Jew, within the Jew rabbit line, especially for the Jew rabbits. And that's what's happened here, in my opinion. That's what's happened the whole time, and that's some of the panic ensuing among the neocons, and some of the panic ensuing among what's going on in the Middle East. He is basically, and he's taking orders, but he's taking orders from American? No. He's taking orders from Elisters, who are all connected to European royalty, the Brzezinskis. The Brzezinskis will get into it with the banksters. Now, historically, they have an agreement. Soros walks back and forth. You know, he's a little colonel or whatever he is for Rothschild. They walk back and forth. They yippity-yap. They have a historic agreement. But if there is a split, that will make a difference. And so that's my opinion, and you were listening very closely. He's not owned by who you think he's owned by. They have all around him. They have a historic agreement with this group. Historically, I believe history will turn out that there are periods of time when the banksters had it over among the European elite, royalty, quote-unquote. You know, divine right to rule white rabbits. They've had it, there are periods of time when they've screwed them over. There are periods of time when the Elisters have screwed them over. I believe you're in one such period of time when they may look to get rid of it. But I've got a clue. I've got an ace in the hole. We'll look for a particular clue in this. I'm looking at this particular piece. We see Saudi royal concern over growing regional unrest. As you look to Libya and all the games going on, no one's talking about what the big deal is. The big deal is Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. Bahrain is basically a Shia state run by the Sunni. And the Sunni ruler has a connection to the House of Saud. They always do. There's always a connection between these guys, no matter whether you're on the bankster side of the equation, the little Jew rabbits, or you're on the elitesters. There's always a connection. And what we will look for, if the sellout has been deep, we will look for actually Saudi Arabia to come under increasingly unrest and for something to happen to the House of Saud, the House of Saud to fall in front of this war, or somewhere around this war. We will also look for Bahrain. Bahrain's a big deal because the Fifth Fleet is stationed there. Bahrain, of course, is a Sunni leader connected to the House of Saud, ruling 70% Shia. What's interesting about the unrest in Bahrain is, one, it's not been covered a lot. Two, the Fifth Fleet stationed there. That means our Navy stationed there. And more important than all this, the Sunni, certain elements of the Sunni who are in the minority there have joined in with the Shia and wanting to overthrow the Bahrain tyrants, the people running things. How this goes is anyone's guess. But if, and it's not if the Elisters have sold them out. In my opinion, they have sold them out. But we will know how deep this goes as a sellout if Saudi Arabia gets toppled. Can Saudi Arabia be toppled by a 15% minority? Well, if you got the President of the United States, who's in bag with Pink Rabbit Elisters, and the Pink Rabbit Elisters, the Bushes, the Harrimans, the Queen of England, wants to make a move on certain elements of the banksters, especially the Jew rabbits, well, that's how you do it. You just pound them into oblivion or support it outside the box. They got all kinds of elements of the CIA. And, of course, this goes into sort of a conspiracy channel, but it's the going thing. But if Saudi Arabia falls, if Bahrain falls, and you are a white rabbit caught in Israel, don't dig, swim, because all hell will break loose. And this was not accidental. This would mean a big sellout. A sellout the likes of which hasn't happened in hundreds, if not thousands of years. That maybe they're going to use, how could they get leverage on them? Well, I've talked about this several times. There's another element that showed up on their desktop on September 11, 2001. Another element, they ain't Arabs. One of the most fascinating quotes, not to go off on a tangent, but this is important to understand how devastating this event was to the banksters. That those Twin Towers, not the attack itself, not setting the Reichstag on fire, but the fact that the Reichstag got burned down, the fact that those Twin Towers came down. Let me give you a quote. Let me jump back to the bankster lines, and let me give you a quote on when this started heating up. Let's go back in time because the Elitesters had, you know, the banksters and the Elitesters at the top of Anglo-America. the American elites and the Anglo elites in jail, in Judeosphere, the elites, the banksters and the elitesters cut a deal. They cut a deal with the devil. And that's simply a fact. Most people don't like that because they don't think this group's real. They are real. The fifth column, Nazi International, I don't care what you call them, they cut a deal with the devil. And the devil came calling one morning. And that devil, who they had a deal with, they never really had a deal with. And that devil may be peeling groups off. And the first group they'd peel off as they launch in Teutoburg Forest, the analogy I keep giving, and again, this is ongoing conversation, as they start peeling these groups off, panic sets in. You know, sooner or later, if you're setting something up, you're going to make yourself known to pretty much anyone watching. And on September 11, 2001, we have a strange event. We have a terrorist attack, which gets the American to the war on terror, America's big military apparatus. And after that, we have some of the most fascinating quotes I've heard in my lifetime. And I'm going to go over them. These are quotes that generally everyone has heard. In most explicit descriptions yet of the Bush administration intentions, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said Thursday the retaliation would be continued until the roots of terrorism are destroyed. These people try to hide. They won't be able to hide forever. They think their harbors are safe, but they won't be safe forever. It's not simply a matter of capturing people and holding them accountable, but removing the sanctuaries, removing the support system, ending states who sponsor terrorism. That's a pretty famous quote by Paul Wolfowitz. No news there. They want to go to war. Jew rabbits, neocon rabbits want to go to war. Neocons are pretty much interchangeable with Jew rabbits. Yes, they are. but the big quote, the one that I know by heart, and it's pretty rare for me to know something by heart because I'm gifted with a horrible memory. But the Mossad chief talked about World War III started September 11th. And they always think in these terms, they always think in these elongated terms, especially the neocons, World War III, World War IV, and all that kind of stuff. But the Mossad chief made a fascinating statement. This is carried by WorldNet Daily, July 5th, 2002. I remember it like it was yesterday. Talked about the true character of the, quote, new war, revealed that day on September 11th. The head of Israel's intelligence agency stated in a speech that he believed World War III began on September 11th. When terrorists attacked the United States. And this was made by Ephraim Halevi. And he was the chief of Mossad. I don't think he is anymore. But he spoke at a meeting of NATO. It was a NATO Alliance Council in Brussels, Belgium. And basically the speech was as follows. And I want you to listen to this carefully. Because I remember it like yesterday. We must shorten the days of criminal countries and entities that act not only as lords of their destinies, but as lords of your destinies and ours. That's heavy duty. This is a Mossad chief talking to NATO, saying we must shorten the days of criminal countries and entities. I'm focusing on the entities. That act not only as lords of their destinies, but as lords of your destiny and ours. He's talking to all his comrades there in NATO. It's a fascinating quote. It's one of the most famous Jew rabbit quotes that I've ever linked onto. Because if you know anything about Al-Qaeda, if you know anything about all these Arab games and all these terrorist games and all these Muslim games, they've let this group into the West and they can't control them. This group has heavy-duty links coming out of World War II with another group. We've talked about that group infinitely. Whether or not anyone wants to believe in them, I don't care. You're gonna find out about them one way or another. But something showed up on the doorway on September 11, 2001, and someone thought they had a deal they didn't have. And that came in very pronounced. The Twin Towers are something my enemy, especially the bankster side, my enemy, it actually goes back, in my opinion, to the actual agreement itself. That's their banking dynasty, is always shown by the Twin Towers, their private banking dynasty. And you usually don't burn down your calling card. You know, Hitler will set a Reichstag fire. He's not necessarily going to burn the thing down in front of the world or blow up all the swastikas in Germany. The world doesn't actually work like that. These symbols mean a lot. They have a big Masonic meaning. But the Twin Towers in New York, in the Empire State, it's a big deal. And then you have this quote from Paul Wolfowitz that I wasn't paying attention to, simply because I thought he was talking about, you know, the axis of evil, yada, 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 and the focus is on Iran, because World War III is always about Iran. And of course it was. His focus was on Iran and Iraq and whatever else. What, Pakistan at the time, or North Korea, I'm sorry. But we must shorten the days of criminal countries and entities that act not only as lords of their destiny, but as lords over your destiny and ours. Now who in the hell could have a lord over their destiny among the almighty Jew rabbits? Not only have a lord over their own destiny, but as a lord over Israeli destinies. Who? Who could be a lord over their destiny? And he's talking, of course, to mostly the Anglo apparatus, which of course is NATO. He's talking to the neocons. He's talking to pink rabbit banksters. He's talking to pink rabbit elitesters. He's talking to anyone with ears. Who in the hell could be a lord over their own destiny and a lord over my enemy's destiny? He's telling you someone is a lord over not only their own destiny, but is a lord over our destiny. We have problems here on the table, gentlemen. It's precisely what he's saying, but it's a fascinating quote. And I don't think he's BSing. And I don't think he's talking about Arabs, because I know for a fact they control the House of Saud, just like Hosni Mubarak, just like they can play endless games with, tin pot dictators like Gaddafi. But what I believe is that there's a historic split, and that historic split doesn't mean anything. If the Habsburgs are going to split from the Rothschilds, it doesn't mean anything. But it would one morning if the Habsburgs control a president and the other side doesn't have them. The other side has Johnny Boy McCain. Then it means something. Now, as an American, none of them are American. None of our historical symbols or ideals mean jack squat to Talibama. But it is interesting on what he's being used for. And that's the point. I mean, he's a little dog and pony show, but that's an interesting quote. And in this particular podcast, I have to jump around like that to try to fill you in on my thinking and how it evolves. But anyone that's listened to this podcast from the beginning, you get the whole spiel. There's more here than meets the eye, but at the same time, everything's right out in front of everyone's face. But these two sides, I believe, even when you get into Glenn Beck, elitester, he represents them. I don't believe anything to the contrary unless he says the mantra on the air. Elitester is on one side of the equation, and you have, Alex Jones, who was bankster, who has, if you look at Real Jews News, I'll put up the piece about his connection to certain elements in America who are blatantly Jew rabbit, who are blatantly answering to Rothschild and company. So you got these two sides, and Alex Jones, of course, is firing at Glenn Beck for stealing some of his stuff, and he did. Glenn Beck has stolen a lot of stuff. Glenn Beck just went right up to the line on Detroit and said Detroit was suffering. he did a comparison between Detroit and Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And the Japanese cities made it back because of free market capitalism. And Detroit didn't make it back because of socialism. Now, but in this piece, he says the crazy stuff, but he goes right to the edge. And this is I expect these two groups to really start going at it as the neocons, who are way down on the totem pole, realize what's happening. We go back into this conversation I had with my listeners that as soon as they realize they've been sold out, they're going to go nuts. When that happens, I don't know. But one event I will look for to know how deep this sellout goes. Am I saying Israel's been sold out? Yes. You've been sold. And they sent you COD. Yeah, but Rothschild, that's nothing new for the Rothschilds to sell out the Jews. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, it may mean more than we know, but at this time on the calendar, but I don't think that's anything new. But we will know how deep this sellout goes. We will know how ugly this is going to be if you see Saudi Arabia fall, if you see a Hosni Mubarak moment there and Bahrain. If you see these two fall, you know this is going to be ugly. Don't run out of Israel. Don't dig out of Israel. Swim as fast as you can. Get the nearest boat. Get out of there. Because all hell will break loose. But the elitesters, in my opinion, there is one side of the equation, my listeners, alternative news and researchers, who understand the concept of groups within groups, who understand the concept of waging war by deception, who believe that there's more to this religion, Judaism, than meets the eyes. There's another part that understands the Rockefeller and Rothschilds, and that believe that they control everything. Well, neither is entirely true. There's a historic agreement between the elites, and you see this time and time again. And as white rabbits, when we're big on the news and Jews tips, we focus on the Jews. But as that wise man was standing over top of me, asked me over and over again, who's they that lets them run around? But someone has found out a whole lot about our enemy, a whole lot about the game they play. A whole lot about all their little tricks, and information on the elitesters is coming out. It's barreling out. It's interesting that they cut a swath through Europe, and pretty much, with the murder of the Tsar and the Bolshevik Revolution, we can say that old royalty ceased, and we have nothing but new royalty. Or what called themselves, the Queen of England, and we don't know anything about these people other than they sold us out and tried to kill us in the last 50 years. But what is interesting is they always pulled one particular thing, and the Asians will point this out, my Asian listeners, that they they go into different countries and they marry into that nationality, and then they call themselves that nationality. It's fascinating because what we're seeing to be true in America is something but multiracial among the same group. If you look at Al Gore has a daughter that married a Chinese man. I think that's kind of interesting. Could it just be multiculturalism or multiracial voodoo on the poor WASP? Well, I think you're going to push comes to shove. You're going to find out that he's not what you think he is. Yeah. And then we got the other side of the equation, you know, the Bushes. The Bushes' son married into a Mexican, married a Mexican woman and has a son, George Bush III or whatever he is, and they're trying to promote him as being next president over South, over all the North of South America and emperor and everything. But they did this type of thing all through Europe. So I think it's fascinating observation, because that's what we see to be true now, but from a multiracial perspective. What is the nature of their game? What's different about them? I don't know, but if you would have told me 10 years ago that a German researcher who mapped the genome for Neanderthals said that the 4% Neanderthal across the globe is concentrated in one region, and that some elements of the Middle East may be up to a third Neanderthal still, so I would bet money that such a hybrid couldn't exist from a racial perspective. Because it would be too unstable. And they do look a little unstable, don't they? So, I mean, I'm game for anything now. I don't know what's up with them, but something's up with them. I'll say this once and again. They have partners. But into this situation, how I will know there has been a serious betrayal. I already know there's been a betrayal. How I will know immediately how deep this goes, is if Saudi Arabia, the House of Saud, falls, and if Bahrain falls. Now, could that happen? Well, sure, if there's been a sellout. I mean, you've got all different kinds of assets. They can take these guys out. You know, if there's a connection between Hosni Mubarak, Israel, the House of Saud, who has a connection to the leader of Bahrain, you've got the Iranians who, of course, have Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is the real deal. Hezbollah has a complete society. If America were to go Muslim and you wanted to set up a Shia state, they would come in, they could run everything, not just military. They have a whole entire society. And they have a whole entire society in Bahrain that is totally separate from Iran. Although they have connections there, they can run everything indefinitely. They're like an independent, even much more than a cell. They're just totally independent indefinitely. But that is how Hezbollah runs things, and they've been primed for one thing, and that one thing is war. So how this ends up is anyone's guess, but that is an update on the elitesters and my thinking and the breakdown as we come into World War III. That is the event I am looking for, and not to know who's been sold out. I know they've been sold out. I know with the election, Obama was a disaster. Rothschild throwing a big dinner party for John McCain is kind of odd because you would think he'd have both sides of the equation. Under normal circumstances, the Habsburg and the Rothschilds work together. But if there's a split, if someone's been peeled, that election would matter. Of course, they're all traitors to us, but they're all pink rabbits, right? They all kind of look like us and have no loyalty to us, with the exception of the mulatto prince. And I think it's kind of interesting that many elements of the elitesters have really shown themselves indifferent, in my opinion, to anti-Semitism of late. Even at the Republican conference, you had all kinds of quotes going on in the neocons, and they were blatantly Jewish comments disguised. I think they've basically been cut loose. Whether or not they've been cut loose by the Rothschild set or who were pushed over the barrel, or whether this split is going to go deep within that set. And elements of this royals are going to seek revenge on them for some nonsense they pulled way back when. And they're always up to nonsense. The bankers cause all kinds of nonsense. But what most people focus on is what is different about the banksters and the neocons. And they don't focus on these elitesters who are always letting them do everything. They don't focus on the Habsburgs who are always letting the werewolves run around and guard, you know, the werewolves guard the vampires, not the other way around. So it's kind of interesting, and I'm looking forward to see how this goes. And of course, let's get back in the news after that tangent and that runaround. But I had to do that for you to give you an update on the elitesters, on the update on what's going on, and answer that question, because I do answer direct questions if you ask them. But I did say long ago that Obama's not owned by who you think he's owned by. If he's not owned by the Jews, if he's not owned by the Rothschild set, who's he's owned by? Well, the elitesters. He has connections to European royalty. Again, all these guys are connected. All these guys. Every time I think that Jimmy Carter's not related to Clinton, Bill Clinton, guess again. Every time I think one of them's not related to a certain line of European royals, guess again. There's always a connection between them. Now, what is a connection? Is it like, Asians are saying that 80% of them are related to one maternal line? I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with them, but hearing what I've heard about Neanderthals, I'm game for anything. And there is an update for my listeners. An interesting publication put out a piece on Neanderthals. There is an interesting piece on Neanderthals put out by a publication that is implicitly white, considered white nationalist, or what I call white normal. It's the Barnes Review, and I'm going to put this up. I haven't read this yet, but it came out in May, June 2010. And any of the alternative news and research listeners, any of the listeners that don't have this, it would be pretty interesting. It talks about Khazar Neanderthals. Are the Khazars Neanderthals? And it talks about the Neanderthal equation from a pretty much implicitly white, or as I call it, white normal perspective. And I'll put that up. You can order the independent one for only $10. I haven't read it, but I am going to get it because it has some pretty interesting things by Jewish scholar Stan Gooch, who said, my ancestors were Neanderthals, and he's talked all about this type of thing. So it's kind of interesting. But I'll put it up on my Twitter, and you can read about it. But now back to what we were talking about before. Saudi royal concern over growing regional unrest. They have something to be concerned about, maybe. And of course, Putin warns West on North African democracy building. Putin always plays the good guy, always warning us not to do this crazy stuff. And of course, in my opinion, the people behind Obama and the Taliban want to do crazy stuff. I think they're doing this intentionally. And that's why the neocons and all these other elements are starting to really visibly freak out. I'm surprised it took them so long to catch on, but, you know, some people are kind of slow. U.S.-Russia clash over shared missile program. The U.S. and Russia have kind of got into it over some stuff. I don't really know what's going on with that. As far as I'm concerned, World War III is in the offing, and it'll probably be very soon, sooner rather than later, with all this other stuff picking up speed. Iran to remove fuel from Bashir atomic plant. Iran is back making fuel, dealing with fuel on their Bashir plant that was supposed to be taken down indefinitely. We've talked about this before, but Iran is running around with their nuclear stuff again. I'll put up an interesting piece from Daily Times. You can read about it. Israeli, this came out just on the 25th of February. Israeli could still strike Iran despite Mideast unrest, and I'm sure they'll have to or do something. They got something planned. They have a game plan. Another piece I'm going to put up to jump back and forth would be Alex Jones talking about Glenn Beck. He's talking about Glenn Beck stealing his stuff, and I think he's right. Glenn Beck, I believe, is kind of like a Taliban backed by one side of the equation, and Alex Jones, I believe, to be backed by another side of the equation. This elitester and my enemy fascinates me, because once you find out it's more than meets the eye, once you find out that it's not... That's not just the what you see is what you get little A Foxy Foxman. There's more to the story, and this story goes way back. It always fascinates me. Because we have to know our enemy. Our enemy was able to run around this game because we've never really known our enemy fully. But we're finding out all kinds of interesting things. And to end this this little piece, we're going to talk about... And we're going to hear more and more about the Russians throwing up a fit over this particular thing in the Middle East. That's generally what they do. They know we're going to invade Iraq, but they let us do it. Well, it's not that they can stop us, but once we do it, they cause all kinds of trouble behind the scene. And, of course, here's another piece. Russia warns against backing revolution. But we're going to end this particular talk, and we're going to go into a dissident discussion. And we're going to talk about Tom Clancy's. Tom Clancy's has a new... as a new game coming out. I don't know what it is, Xbox 360 game, 360 game. It's called Tom Clancy's End War Preview, The War to End All Wars. I think it's interesting. Tom Clancy comes out with some interesting books and interesting games that tend to mirror what's going on in the world or what's shaping up. But I'm going to put up a piece about this war. It talks about all hell breaking loose across white rabbit holes. And, World War III is basically what it talks about, one particular scenario. I don't know about the scenario, but I'm going to put it up. But to sum up everything we've talked about, you're in the front part of the end game, right at the point where everyone realizes something's going on. Something's going on in this planet. Someone's making big moves. You got all these revolutions with corporate sponsors going on in America, you know, at the state capitals. And something is going on. We've got the neocons all freaking out all of a sudden. I'm surprised they didn't do it a lot earlier. And you've got all kinds of different things happening. What we will look for is Saudi Arabia, Bahrain. We will keep our eye peeled for any new information about our enemies. We will also stay on a consistent message, because that's our job. That is our job. And And we will keep a lookout. But at a blink of an eye, what you think of as a lot of activity, this is nothing. At a blink of an eye, it will get deafening. And then there'll be a break. And then we go to war. It'll be on the eve of war. I don't know exactly what's going to happen in that break, but I'm guessing you're going to be a little freaked out. It'll be some pink rabbit hocus and pocus. But we will look for this split to widen. We will look for shots among Team Pink Rabbit, Bankster, their Bankster lines, which are always Jewish by and large, or, you know, someone that marries a Jewish girl, like Real Jude News talked about Alex Jones marrying a Jewish girl, and that's why he would be on their side. But I don't like some of the symbols he uses. Some of the symbols he uses, some of the things he says tells me that he's in their plan somehow. But, you know, that's how it starts out. Some nice boy marries a Jewish girl and gets himself into more than he bargains for. But where they're going with this is, where they're going with this is things will keep building. And at a certain point, it's going to be obvious to everyone on Earth that something's going on. But most of my listeners are in tune with this. Your average alternative news and researcher is very in tune with this, because they're already watching all kinds of news events. The white nationalist, paleo-conservative, even the most hard-headed paleo-conservatives are starting to realize something's going on here. It's shaping up. It's the end game. You're coming into the first third as we take the turn into war, and you ain't seen nothing yet. Wait till they start really bringing these groups out and banging their drums. And we will keep this conversation alive. I will keep going over news and views. I will be with you through the end game until they shut down the internet and everything else. Do I think there'll be a time when the president comes on TV and does something crazy? Probably. Yeah, they're going to have to do something outrageous. It's going to be pretty interesting, and that'll be, I'm guessing, before war. But I could be wrong on that. This is all open speculation. We'll keep putting together the pieces of the puzzle for you as best I can. But our job is basically to stay on a consistent message and to be on a consistent message, to be spreading that. And with the new site, our particular web stats, no matter how, and web stats on White Rabbit Radio are kind of like reading tea leaves. But if you have a basket full of web stats, you can get a good idea. And everything is through the roof. There are different elements that I will be talking to in the next discussion. I'm going to call it a dissident discussion. These are people kind of in the know, people that are looking for signals, smoke screens, whatever. I'm going to be pretty blatant about how to come into a consistent message, about how we're going to take down the mantra in a few different components, and I'm going to talk to this group. But hopefully you found the last piece to be entertaining, a heads up on what I believe is going on. Now, of course, it is speculation. Nothing's true until it's true and written in the history books, but of course our history books are all lies anyways. Yeah, I mean, my average listener knows that. And this stuff goes back a lot further than I thought at one time. But we will keep my listeners totally informed, and we're going to go into a dissonant discussion, and we're going to talk about a consistent message. We're going to talk about what next. As our web traffic, even on Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, no one can believe the web traffic they're getting. And everyone, of course, blames White Rabbit Radio for that. In other words, everyone gives White Rabbit Radio the credit simply, or Bob does, simply because he wasn't getting it before White Rabbit Radio. So we can assume that. But we're going to go into a message for the dissidents. And the dissident is anyone white and normal with an opinion. You're a dissident. I'm going to go into some basics of a consistent message, and some basics, some cutout stuff. And everything evolves around the mantra, but the mantra contains many different components. I'm going to go under my particular view on some things, and hopefully you found this entertaining. But we'll be back with you in a minute, and we'll start that process. But before I go to commercial, I'm going to add one more thing in. There's all kinds of interesting pieces coming out. And it makes it difficult to record a podcast doing news and views when all these different news events keep popping out. But there was an article just published that has everything to do with what I'm talking about. It's a neocon article, and I'm surprised it didn't come out sooner. And the neocons are always feisty. They're always feisty. They're always in your face. They want us to go to war against Islam, change Islam, then allow us to be assimilated and browned out of existence so they can have ultimate control. They want a multiracial, multicultural West that they can control, and they won't really compromise anything else. Well, they talk for the banksters, one specific line of the Rockefeller Rothschilds, and they are very inflexible. The Rothschilds and those bankster lines can be a lot more flexible than them. And then, of course, the elitesters who we've been talking about are very, very flexible. They can be a lot more flexible than any of them combined. But one of the interesting things that just came up is that what's her name? I think her name is something Glick. Glick. Let me get her name here. Just wrote a piece, and it's a fascinating piece. I'm going to put it up. It's by Caroline Glick, and she is a neocon. And she wrote it on Front Page Mag, and it just came to my attention. I want to throw it in here because this is a big shot across the bow. Now, they do this in several different ways. And this is the actual title. The West's Proxy War Against the Jews. I'm going to repeat that. The West's Proxy War Against the Jews. Now, most of my listeners are going to say, what's this crazy neocon doing? And the title is very radical. The actual piece itself is typical neocon nonsense. Typical nonsense that someone like Miss Glick would write. But the title really caught my eye because I expect more of this type of thing as events unfold. But what the Elisters have been able to do, and one of the things that they have done, is, you've got the diaspora Jews. The diaspora Jews in America are generally the big powerful group is the neocons now. They have a lot of think tanks, a lot of power. Way too much power. Even George Soros doesn't like them for the power they have in the Republican circles. They don't really have a counterpart in Europe per se. The Jews in Europe generally are driven by Israel. And the Israelis themselves, the settlement community and all the different really racist Jewish communities have made inroads among several of the European nationalists that freak out the neocons. Because the neocons have a totally different vision than actually many of the Israelis and the settler community and some of the more radical Jewish communities in Israel. In so much that they just want Israel to survive, and any deal they have to cut with anyone for Israel to survive, whether they be European white nationalists or whatever. Even Netanyahu supposedly said, look, we'll talk to white nationals or anything to survive. The neocons would never have that. But there's a big difference between sitting on the front lines in Israel and sitting in a skyscraper in New York. I think we can all agree. But there's been a split in the bankster side between those in Israel and the diaspora. When you're dealing with the Jewish groups, there's a big difference between those that live in Israel and those that live outside of Israel. And this split has been taken advantage of to some extent. To the fullest extent, we won't know until this war. But you have all these different European politicians that now side with Israel. They're anti-Muslim, pro-Israel. They basically sound like Glenn Beck. I just mentioned Glenn Beck is an elitester. That's my opinion. That's my two cents. I'm speculating, but I'm banking that he's on their side. But the European opinion is generally shaped by the elitesters. It's not shaped by the banksters these days. You know, France is kind of up for grabs. France can go 50-50. You got pink rabbits at the top. You got the people all ticked off. You got the crazy Muslims. You got the Jews who are pretty much fighting it out in their think tanks because they don't know what to do. You got the Israelis who want the survival of Israel. And they can be pretty flexible when it comes to that. Maybe they think, you know, they'll defeat the Muslims, then we'll get them in the end and they'll brown out, whatever. Whoever they're thinking. They're a lot more flexible than neocons. The neocons are insane. You're gonna fight Islam, you're gonna become multicultural, multiracial, and go extinct. You're nuts. It's just completely nuts. And this piece is interesting because I expect as events start unfolding, and they start fully realizing what type of problems they have. I don't know why it's just now occurring to them for them to write more over-the-top pieces. And this piece, although from the title, it sounds like it's something really over-the-top. The West Proxy War Against the Jews by Ms. Caroline Glick. The West Proxy War Against the Jews. Pretty strong language. It sounds like, there's a Hitler on the loose. And she goes through their usual neocon nonsense. Adds in a few more things, but there's a triangulation going on in the piece between the Western elites, Islam, and when it comes to the elitesters, they've done something pretty interesting that's highly irritating to me. It's highly irritating to most of my listeners because they're pussyfooting around. But what they're doing is splitting. They divided the banksters into the Rothschild set controls the diaspora Jews, but then there's Israel, and Israel is a big headache. It's always been a headache for Rockefeller. Rockefeller has them, they have them on tape talking about paying Israelis $1 million to move to Arizona. It's a big problem. It's a nightmare for them because they're capable of doing anything or partnering with anything. They're used to walking around worrying about their own survival. Worrying about your own survival and worrying about the survival of a state, survival of a nation state is not one and the same. And of course, I've always found that Israelis are pretty flexible. They're not nearly as nuts as their neocon counterparts. They can be, they are racist, certainly. They don't like Muslims, but that is something interesting that I want to throw in. I'm going to throw this piece up. This is must reading because this is the type of thing I expect the neocons to really come out with. Now, if they've been sold deep within the bankster lines, it'll get wild and everything we see turn loose. And you may see some of the leadsters come out more and more against them or turn some of the Republican elements who are still very anti-Semitic, although they don't like talking about it, and turn them loose against them or something. I don't know, Pat Buchanan style. But it should be interesting to see how this unfolds. But the Glenn Becks are sounding just like the European elites, pro-Jewish, anti-Islam, and this is what you see all across Europe, and it drives us crazy, of course. But it's something I just had to throw in there because. The strategy that has been adopted, the Hans Christian Strache, he goes, and he might be the next prime minister of Austria. He's tooling around in Israel. You know, he loves the Jews. I don't know what these guys are up to. Geert Wilders is a little bit different. He's rumored to be part Jewish, and I think he's married to a Jew. But anyways, this game that the European elitesters are playing, between Israel and not talking to the neocons and going straight to the Israelis, the settler community, which has, you know, they don't really care about European nationalists. They don't care about anything except living in their country, expanding their country, and their most immediate goal is, of course, you know, what are they going to do with Islam? So it's interesting that their problem has become Europeans' problems, which is by design. And the only thing you can really do out of it, go with it, is World War III and then hope to try to get Europeans after the fact or something. But they're more interested in their survival, and they've been peeled off. You've got two different groups vying in Western civilization. You've got the elitesters who are working directly with... in Europe, we're working directly with Jews in Israel, and you've got neocons in the Anglosphere, by and large, neocons who don't really like that, in my opinion. In my opinion, the neocons are very, very, very extreme, although I'm guessing for survival of Israel, anything goes. It's rather entertaining, and I was just told Kevin McDonald has an interesting piece talking about some different elements called the Wilder Syndrome. Let me pull it up here. Yes, it was just published. Well, it was actually published on December 27, 2010, but I'll put that up for you guys to read one of Kevin McDonald's pieces. But that's my particular take on it. You're going to hear the Glenn Beck sound just like the Europeans, and you're going to hear the neocons become more and more extreme as they realize they're in trouble, as we pick up speed into the big crescendo. And there'll be all kinds of big marches, and the pink rabbits will be out all over the place. And what you've seen is, of course, an agreement between the left and Islam. We went into this before. How it turns out and how wild this will be into the war should be, you know, rather interesting. What the neocons plan on doing in this war is also going to be interesting. But I'll put up these pieces for you, and it's something to keep an eye on. The extreme language of the neocons, the West proxy war against the Jews, and that's absolutely kind of absurd, but from their perspective, it's not. If they've been sold out and they're starting to realize it, and they have been, eventually they're going to realize it, and they're going to really start stomping their feet and whining and crying. Now, if the banksters sold them out, there's really little they can do. If they've been sold out deep within the Rothschild lines, well, who knows how wild this will get. But anyways, keep your eye on Bahrain, keep your eye on Saudi Arabia, keep your eye on extremist neocon language. You could see pieces like this come out with somewhere like France, too. France is kind of, they're in bed with the... they're in bed with the Anglo elites. They're in bed with Judeosphere, Nicolas Sarkozy. But the European elites are playing an interesting game here, the elitesters. And Glenn Beck, well, of course, he's doing the same thing. In the next piece, we're going to talk to the dissidents, and we're going to go back over some basics. And now a word from our sponsor. Have you ever said to yourself, gee, I would love an undercover lover? Or maybe you said to yourself, gee, I would like to be an undercover lover. We know exactly how you feel. For a limited time only, on WhiteRabbitRadio.net, you can buy an undercover lover. You can be an undercover lover. Yes, for only 25 carats. It is a great investment because all the money goes to fight white rabbit genocide, which is the thing we're about here at WhiteRabbitRadio.net. So if you're looking for an undercover lover, or if you're looking to be an undercover lover, or if you're just looking to have the coolest undercover lover in the history of the undercover lovers, we have just the ticket for you, all at a very, very low price. Yeah, so hop on over there and pull up that merchandise tab. And when you see the undercover lover, you'll go wild at how beautiful it is. And hit that buy button. Support fighting white rabbit genocide in the easiest way possible. Be an undercover lover. This part of the podcast, I'm going to talk to dissidents. I'm going to talk to anyone white and normal that has seen our site, whether it be Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar at WhitakerOnline.org, which there's a link to it on WhiteRabbitRadio.net, or my site, which is White Rabbit Radio, and are trying to figure out what on earth is going on, where's all this noise coming from, what's this consistent message stuff, how on earth did you get it out there so far, so fast, so quick. I've got messages from old conservatives wanting to know any tips that they can understand or tips that they can get in a short podcast because they don't particularly care for the podcast. Podcast not necessarily designed for that crowd, but at the same time, they want to know what we're doing. They wanted me to talk to them about some simple basic things so they could get their head around why this thing has been so successful so fast. Or exactly what we're doing or what they can learn from it, which is only understandable. And there's a big group of dissidents. I call them dissidents. In reality, they're real revolutionaries, but that term has been coined by my enemies so much that I use the term dissidents. We're under a particular model at Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, and old Bob Whitaker is under a model that they used to bring down the Soviet Union. And that model was with actual sound. Yeah, I've talked consistently about this, but sound is extremely violent. I've talked about this in many different ways, whether it be, you know, using an actual opera singer, which many of you have seen break glass. Sound can do that. Sound is a pressure wave. And a closed society cannot hold up to its own internal contradictions. So using the analogy of a closed society that they've created in Western civilization where we can't talk about race without going to the gulag, vis-a-vis comparing and contrasting that with the closed society of the Soviet Union where you can't talk about anything other than scientific materialism or disagree with scientific materialism without going to the gulag, is pretty much a clear template, and that's what he's using. Now, getting a message out, you've got to go around the dissidents, because dissidents, whether it be paleoconservative, I throw them all in one group, any of Bob's friends, any of the guys that have known him for years, to get out a message, you've got to go around the dissidents. In the Soviet Union, dissidents don't use other people's materials. Dissidents generally only write to other dissidents. Dissidents are always frustrated. In the Soviet Union, they were very frustrated that the actual community would agree with them on a lot of issues, but yet at the same time weren't agreeing with them on a few fundamental facts to take action. And it always creates a barrier of frustration. And I'm going to read you a short piece about that I wrote for this particular podcast, that I put it on a couple different online websites and ended up making it on Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, and where I talk about the comparisons between the struggle for the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, as I call them, and I call them that simply because that's the legal definition under international law, Indo-European. But this particular struggle, the compare and contrast between what the white dissidents go through and what the Soviet dissidents went through, because it's very, very similar. And some different techniques, some different things you can learn from the mantra. It's very difficult for a dissident to get their heads around a consistent message. So much so, I wasn't about to design a podcast to try to do that. At the same time, once you have a platform, once you've proven some level of success, usually you're going to get interest on what can I learn from this, or what can I do to help out, or what are you guys doing to make all this racket? You know, success... It is widely believed that the vast majority of dissidents don't want to succeed. Well, they just get frustrated dealing with the same pitfalls, and so they turn inward. They start dealing with only dissidents. There's about 20% of the, let's call them paleoconservative, white nationalist, white normal, that are so turned off by the average, the things that they have to go through to talk about race, that they don't want to talk about it around non-dissidents. And that's this podcast is basically for that particular individual, but a lot of different parties can learn from it. Now, as far as the template we're under, again, is what they used to bring down the Soviet Union. That template, that model is working. It's working like clockwork, interesting enough. And things are going a lot faster because we're not dealing with copying machines and old printing. We're dealing with a new format. This new format was so unique, so dynamic, no one really has a handle on it. No one's reading a textbook or everyone's kind of feeling their way through. When you see these so-called Twitter revolutions, they don't actually have a manual for that yet. They're just kind of feeling their ways through this new technology. What we do know is things move faster, obviously. Things have to be fine-tuned a lot quicker. Everything that would appear to be a negative can be a positive when it's moving quickly. But at the same time, there is no real experience on it. Typically, when you're putting a group on a consistent message, it's pretty straightforward. Right now, in somewhere like Minnesota, the AFL-CIO is putting people on a consistent message or spreading a consistent message in America. And it's pretty easy. It's a few slogans, it's a few banners. And the groups that do it are actually paid to do it. What's been amazing about the actual, you know, YouTube videos and stuff like that is I've never done one. I did one for Christmas. That's it. 'Twas the night before Christmas. And Bob has never done one. But our stuff is all over the place. It's very difficult to get someone to do that without paying them. Traditionally, that's how it works. So there's been a lot of interest in what we're doing. And to be quite honest with you, in this particular podcast, a lot of what I was doing in the beginning was a complete experiment. No one would know if it would work because this is such a new medium. The internet is just so new for what we're doing. At the same time, a lot of it has been a lot more successful than anyone who ever thought possible, so much so that if I ever think about quitting or redesigning something or redoing something, there are parties that don't even listen or like the particular content of the podcast that would threaten me with physical violence associated with old Bob Whitaker because it's been so successful at doing one particular thing, spreading this message. So in getting into this, I'm going to read a short piece, and then we're going to talk about a handful of very simple things you can use to communicate where you can set ambushes and not walk into pitfalls, where anyone talking with anyone normal and white, you can jump around $500 billion worth of social engineering very quickly. I'm going to read this piece, and I'll be back with you, and we're going to go into this discussion. Old Bob Whitaker liked this particular piece because he lived through this particular time period. I did not. I did not live through this. Everything I know about practical politics, I know from old Bob and guys like old Bob that have a tremendous amount of experience. One of the challenges with the particular format you're in, internet, is no one had any experience. No one knew how to approach it. No one knew how to... everyone's feeling their way through it. But I wrote a particular piece that ended up on another dissonant site, paleo-conservative site, and Bob put it up on his site, and I'm going to read it here for you. Title of the piece is H. Avenger Reminds Us of Another Impossible Victory. And, of course, H. Avenger, Horace the Avenger, is me. White nationals are going through what Soviet dissidents went through in the last stages of the Soviet Union. Who in the hell wants to be a Soviet dissident? It was a recipe for a lot of abuse, and generally they looked like masochists to the public. Of course, the public agreed with the dissidents. That was the problem with the Soviet Union. The public agreed with the dissidents, even if they did not have the courage to become one. The challenge was that saying the wrong thing in the Soviet Union and you would lose your job or worse, the gulag. The struggle was very similar to ours. The white public will always agree with the average paleo-conservative white nationalist on almost every issue, just as the Soviet public would agree with the dissidents on all the issues. Now, what happened in the Soviet Union to change things for the better? Well, the big activity was in regards to something called Samizdat. And let me interject here. Samizdat is how they spread their consistent message. Samizdat were basically the pamphlets or even the little newspapers that carried their message. The problem for the dissidents was always the same. They mostly wrote their samizdat to cater to other dissidents. And there were always a lot of backbiting, etc. So how did they turn things around and help make history bringing down the Soviet Union? A handful of dissidents started listening to actual professionals, and I'll interject here, they were from the CIA, who helped them fine-tune their message to a razor's edge. A small group of dissidents came out with a very similar message against the system. They basically learned to say what they wanted to say without going to the gulag. They stopped writing to other dissidents and started writing for the public. This in turn spread like wildfire. Why? Because the public always wanted to be against the system. They always wanted to say something. Now they could do it without losing their jobs or worse. The Soviet Union was soon gone, and few realized what had happened. Then the dissidents became very famous and some very wealthy, but they never became famous for nitpicking writing to other dissidents. In fact, those facts are all but forgotten right along with the invincible Soviet machine. And in this particular talk, I'm going to talk to the actual dissidents. I'm going to talk to simple things. When the dissidents' message is being agreed to, and many of my listeners, I'm guessing everyone listening to this right this second, will say, Horace, every time I talk to a white person, they agree with the vast majority of content. What is going wrong? What are we doing? What can we learn from what you guys are doing? And I will give you three simple tips. They're all contained within the mantra, but I realize that for putting a dissident or putting someone that's been around for 20 or 30 or even a decade and a half on a consistent message is very difficult. That's why I didn't design a podcast to try to do it. You have to pretty much go around that group and then come back to them and try to help them along. But generally speaking, what you are doing is you are transporting them back to another place in their life with a handful of buzzwords. What you're doing is going up against the machine, as I say. And let me go through this with you. And it's very simple and very easy because sound, the wonderful thing about sound is I can make my point over and over again with you in this particular case. Right now we're dealing with a situation of Western civilization where there's an attempt to genocide Europeans, the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, as I call them, all white people, by their own leaders. It's pretty astounding. And a pack of Jews. Yeah, the Jews are involved. Don't let them kid you. Their elites are up to their necks in it. That's one of their problems. But there's a lot of people, parties that agree with them. The Johnny McCains, in America, there would be famous examples. Basically, white people have been sold out by their own by and large. The Jews don't exactly wave a magic wand. They have partners, and I've talked about this extensively. The problem has basically been traitors, for lack of a better word. But basically, when you're going and talking to the average white person, the dissident always is seeing the same thing they were seeing in the Soviet Union. They agree on content. They'll agree with everything. But what's going wrong? Where is there a disconnect? And the disconnect always is around a handful of words. And in this case, in this particular case, when it comes to our particular message, it is very simple to pinpoint. Our enemy has spent a virtual fortune in social engineering. All that social engineering is combined around a handful of buzzwords and phrases always used pretty much by the racialists going back hundreds of years. The first one we're going to talk about is the white race. You're never going to hear someone like me use that phrase, the white race. Our enemy has spent a fortune on the white race. The white race is actually distant. It creates an abstraction. But the biggest challenge is, as soon as you say the white race, it leads to a million different questions. And we'll get back to those questions in a second, but the actual biggest challenge you confront is when you say that to the average non-dissident. Now, when you're talking to dissidents, it doesn't really matter, but when you're talking to normal white people, when you say the white race, you're transporting them. Transporting them where? You're transporting them back to a time in their life when they were heavily programmed. They were programmed off a handful of phrases and buzzwords, and the white race is one such phrase. You know, what is the white race? Who is the white race? And then they create this huge social engineering program to sow all these different doubts and all these different types of things in their heads. In fact, the average anti-racist activist, what we call anti-white, that's just a code word. Anti-racist is just a code word for anti-white, actually has a series of questions to ask anyone that says the white race and then has a series of questions to ask them based on their response. All engineered around this phrase, the white race. But sound is very pervasive. If you've ever been walking down the street, and I know you have, and you heard a song from your childhood, maybe it's an old Christmas jingle, and immediately you're transporting back in time to when you first heard that as a child. Or maybe you're with that famous, your favorite boyfriend, or your husband. Let's talk to you like this. Maybe you're with your husband, and you hear a song from when you first got engaged, and it transports you immediately back to that particular mind, that particular time in your life, and what was going on in your mind. It's actually it's like a transporter. It immediately will transport you back to where you originally heard it. It doesn't matter whether it's your favorite. Maybe it's even your favorite. Your favorite cartoon, watching or hearing your favorite cartoon, those sights and sound immediately transports you to the time when you were a childhood and you first saw Scooby-Doo or you first saw Bugs Bunny. Sound is very nostalgic. That's what you are doing when you say phrases like the white race. You are immediately transporting your audience into $500 billion worth of social engineering and trying to get through that. And that's one of the difficulties for the dissidents. The dissidents are using a language. They're going up against a language barrier that isn't significant. It's just in a handful of phrases that an enemy has spent a fortune engineering around. So what do we say instead of the white race? We always say my race, our race. I mean, if you're standing there and you're white, no one has ever asked you what race you are. Why would you say the white race? In Bob Whitaker's mind, old Bob can make a case that this phrase in general was created by our enemies when they took over the anthropology departments in the early 19th centuries. I don't know about that, but they really latched onto it because it's kind of an abstraction. What is the white race? Who is the white race? You're basically leaving yourself open-ended for a lot of questions. And that's not generally the problem. The challenge is that these questions are well prepared for. You're going up against a $500 billion machine. If I say my race, our race, if I say our white workers, our white working class, if I make these phrases, our white politicians, I'm taking ownership. There's only one question someone can ask me when I say my race. What is your race? And it's a very silly question. And there's only two types of people that will ask this silly question. One is one we want to hammer. I call it the political correctness officer. It is someone in every area, and there's only one of them, heavily programmed. They're the ones that if you hand out a flyer, they'll call the police on that racial flyer over nothing. They're the ones that if you say something wrong way, they'll report you to this association or that association. The only person that this phrase, my race, our race, will bring out is that person. There is another type of person, a kid that doesn't know better. This podcast isn't designed to deal with them because that's pretty much, it's pretty straightforward to talking to a kid about race. And that can be by and large a byproduct of the social engineering. The social engineering is addressing the means. On this program, we address the ends. The ends is genocide. That's the social engineering is just one of the means, one of the major means. But we're not talking about the kid that's confused that asks, "What do you mean by my race?" I'm talking about the actual smartass that comes out and asks it to try to pull you out of the closet or try to label you, and you can go anywhere you want to with it. Because you are basically engineering who, not only what question can be asked you, what is your race, but who has the highest probability of asking it. The average white person is not going to ask what your race is. They already know that. Also, you're making it personal. It's not something distant or abstract. You're not transporting them back into a $500 billion social engineering machine. You never want to transport your audience back into your enemy's camp. That's kind of common sense. So it's a strange phenomenon, but at the same time, at the right time, a handful of words, a handful of phrases can make a huge difference. Is it bulletproof? No. But by and large, it can take you anywhere you want to go with it. When you say my race, again, typically the very few times I've been asked, and you'll get asked very few times. I usually say these days, are you anti-white? Because only an anti-white would ask me something as silly as, what's my race? And most of them don't even realize they've asked that. It's Pavlov's dogs. They're so programmed. It's kind of like you're a dissident and you're at Council of Concerned Citizens, a Council of Conservative Citizens, one of their big CFCC meetings, and you say the white race, and people ask you what you mean by that. You're never going to do that at that meeting. Dissidents don't ask such silly questions. They already know. But what you're doing is not talking to dissidents. You're talking to a people that have been, someone's attempted to wipe them out, and there's a lot of programming involved. But you can sidestep all those questions that the anti-whites will ask you. You can sidestep all that programming by just one simple rephrase. Instead of using the white race, say my race, say our race. And instead of walking into a pitfall of getting into arguments of over all this minutia that the anti-whites love to argue about, all you're doing, why they love to argue about it, because one, they have a lot of different questions, they spend a lot of time developing them. You can sidestep that and basically, instead of walking in a pitfall, set an ambush. And you can go anywhere you want to with it. I gave you my simple explanation I've been doing of late. Are you anti-white? Because only a crazy anti-white would ask me something as silly as my race. I'm obviously white. And then you can go into the mantra, you can do anything you want. You can go anywhere you want to with it because you're not only dictating the question someone can ask you, you're dictating in all high probability who's going to be asking you the question. And it is a bonanza. And in fact, all the Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar people, that's something, if you didn't realize, that's what he's doing in the mantra. In the last part of the mantra, he says, but if I tell the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race, you see, he's combining the two. He's combining the two for a million different reasons. But it's, what's very important is he's putting my race in front of that. Now, I typically don't only say the white race in the mantra, but he's doing that for a particular reason and combining those two. But you're not generally going to hear him say the white race if he's around non-dissidents. It's a no-no. It's a no-no. I can't turn it off and on and talk to dissidents one way and the average white person the other way, another way. So I these days I just say my race or our race, but there's a lot you can do with it. And what I want the Bob's Underground's Graduate Seminar people to do is when you use it, and as you use it, I want you to start gauging responses and tell me what you're doing with it, because you can go into the mantra, you'll get a million opportunities, because there's only one type of person that's going to ask you a question, and you already know what question they're going to ask you. You walk around, by doing this, the average dissident can walk around $500 billion worth of programming, and immediately avoid transporting them into the enemy's camp, back into the time when mommy professor was brainwashing them. You can keep them in your camp and immediately get to what you have in common instead of having to fight through all the programming. And next up we're going to talk about one pitfall dissidents always go through. Dissidents always are unduplicatable. The knowledge they know is unduplicatable. It's only ever duplicated by a handful. At the same time, for the dissident to be effective, you have to leave them with something that is duplicatable. And people love defending themselves. People love defending themselves. They hate being called names. White people especially hate being called names. Everyone has either been called a racist, everyone white across the top of the planet and anywhere else, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, you've all been called racist, or your friend has. And giving them something to say to immediately defend themselves, written by professionals, gives you big kudos. More will use this than anything I've ever seen. No one's ever seen anything quite like this particular phrase. What do you do when you're called a racist? Well, you don't answer that. You just say, in your opinion, I'm a racist. You're just saying that because I'm white. Anti-racism is just a code word for anti-white. In your opinion, I'm a racist. You're just saying it because I'm white. Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white. Say that over and over again, but this type of thing, pointing out the actual structural problems in the system, that only whites can be racist, and doing it in a way that you can do all over the place, is extremely violent in this type of system. It gives the system convulsions. But people, dissidents always make the mistake of trying to leave the people with something that is way over the top that they can never, ever accomplish. Only the dissident can accomplish it. You have to make an impression to the extent that give them something to do to defend themselves. Even before someone can go into a violent revolution or into any type of war situation, you have to get their backs up. They have to defend themselves verbally. It always starts from the inside out. Our people have never been destroyed from the outside in. We've been destroyed from the inside out. They're basically internal communication techniques have been discombobulated through the media and through a variety of other social engineering tools. But basically, you have to give them something to say to defend themselves. And that's the best thing we have. That thing is money. It's money all day. It's irritating. It's a broken record strategy. It's a na-na-na-na-na-na, but it immediately labels the enemy. And that's one thing that's very important. You always want to label your enemy. You do not want to label your enemy what they want to be labeled. They want to be labeled anti-racist, so-called conservatives, liberals, environmentalists. My enemy will only ever achieve one label with me, anti-white. You're just anti-white. Anti-racism is just a code word for anti-white. Everybody's anti-white. In my camp, you're either pro-white or you're pro-white genocide. Or, as Bob says, pro-white or anti-white. But I generally refer to them as anti-white. Everyone's an anti-white. You should never call any anti-racist anti-racist. Anti-racism is just a code word for anti-white. Never label your enemy what they want to be labeled. That labels work. Labels, na-na-na-na-na-na, making fun of people, all this stuff that's not supposed to be nice, it works. It worked on you. It worked on our race. It works. Peer pressure, these things work. They don't want us doing it, but they love doing it. Why? Because they do what works. I have to give my hat off to the enemy. The enemy, by and large, when it comes to labeling, they do what works. The reason most of their social engineering doesn't work is because they go against nature, but that's another story. But when it comes to putting out messages and labeling people, making fun of people, they do that quite well. They do that quite well, but we never call our enemy what they want to be called. No, no, no. You're just anti-white. And these are all, anti-racism is just a code word for anti-white. It is, as one commentator put it, a milk cow with a thousand tits. One Southern commentator, I believe it was, but it is. That is the one that catches on. It's getting out there. Constantly rephrasing your enemy. In your opinion. In your opinion. In your opinion. In your opinion, I'm a white supremacist. You're just saying that because I'm white. Anti-racism is just a code word for anti-white. I say it over everything. Because what they are programmed to do is continuously throw out names. And in the next part, we're going to go into one of the famous. We're going to go into the big three that everyone listening to this has been labeled if you're white with an opinion. Typically, if you're alive on this planet, you know that my enemy, someone's put a lot of money into three things. White supremacism, this label. Neo-Nazi, Nazi. What do we do about these labels? Well, what you do about an armed phrase like that, an armed phrase is a phrase that someone's been a fortune arming. It's kind of like the white race. It's been a fortune on it. You can either walk around it or you confront it directly. When it comes to racists, we confront it directly, just not on their terms. In your opinion, I'm a racist. You're just saying that because I'm white. Anti-racism is just a code word for anti-white. In that particular instance, we're saying something quite interesting. Anti-racism is just a code word for anti. We're stating a fundamental truth. Also, we're actually saying that only whites and everyone white is a racist, which is what they basically say. But if you walk down Toronto, if you're walking down the street in Toronto and you're a lady and you say I'm a racist, funny things are going to happen to you. You can say our stuff all day long and nothing can happen to you in any country, period. They don't like it. This is the type of thing the system fears, but this is the type of thing old Bob Whitaker does. That's the type of thing that this group has done historically in places like the Soviet Union. Now, in the next phrase, we're not confronting an armed phrase. Well, we're actually confronting it directly, but we're disarming it. And this is something very unique that Bob has a particular skill set in. If you read the mantra, I've been asked specifically why he does this. Is there a particular reason for it? Yes. Yes, he always says Nazi is going to kill 6 million Jews. If you've ever read the mantra, he does this. Liberals, but if I tell the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race, liberals and respectable conservatives agree that I'm a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews. Why is he combining Nazis with what the Nazis supposedly did? Well, let's come over to America and let me give you a real example. This is a real life example. There's a young man, James Edwards. Very fine young man, a conservative who runs a radio show, a very successful radio show called The Political Cesspool. It's a real conservative show, and he's really talking about conserving things, like white rabbits. But anyways, James Edwards has never labeled himself anything but a conservative. But if you go to the Wikipedia, if you talk to our enemy, he's a Nazi, he's a neo-Nazi, he's a white supremacist, he's all these things. Why do they do that? They do that to associate him with World War II, and they do that to associate him with the Holocaust and 6 million dead Jews. Now, he can run from that, which will never work because they just keep labeling that. Or he can take it head on. What Bob does is he knows two things. One, the enemy is never going to escape our labels. He's always going to label them anti-white. Two, guess what? We're never going to escape their labels because we can't go up against the machine. But there comes a time when you can turn it into a pun. There comes a time when you can actually flip it on its head. You see, if I say Nazi, neo-Nazi, white supremacist, immediately what am I doing to my audience? I am immediately transporting them into a $500 billion machine designed to kill them. They are transported back in time to when they first got drilled over these phrases and how evil white people came up with them and evil white people killed 6 million Jews and evil white Christians and all that kind of stuff. You got to disarm it. You can't disarm a phrase like that by running from it or running around it. You disarm it by taking it head on and linking it with what they're trying to associate with. And the reason they're calling James Edwards a white supremacist is because why? Hitler was a big white supremacist and he killed 6 million Jews. Why are they calling him a neo-Nazi? Because Hitler was a big Nazi and he killed 6 million Jews. They're trying to do this guilt by association. And they do this very well. The way you disarm it is doing something kind of funny. It seems trivial, it seems trite, but it's actually extremely violent in this type of system. You disarm the phrase by linking what the associations are. Why do you do this? Because it creates a short circuit. In the person you're talking to will create a short circuit. If you say Nazi or neo-Nazi or white supremacist, they're immediately transported back into social engineering and mommy professor brainwashing them. You've got to get through that. Well, you don't want to get through that. We want to stomp all over it. So what we're doing is creating a short circuit. Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews. Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews. We don't say neo-Nazi or white supremacists. We say Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews. We just do one big association. We just put the association all together. If you say Nazi is going to want to kill 6 million Jews, it discombobulates them. It's a short circuit. You're not transporting them back into a bunch of social engineering. You're basically confronting it head on, and it actually starts sounding kind of funny. If Ernest Zundel was on German television saying Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, and of course he's obeying the law. All of our stuff always obeys the law in a way that is kind of cynical and over the top and in your face. It is a nana, 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 but if Ernest Zundel was on German TV saying Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, well, why are you saying this like this, Ernest? Well, the Nazis killed 6 million Jews, and I don't want to go to jail again. Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews, Nazi wants to kill 6 million Jews. It discombobulates the audience. It's a short circuit. You are basically taking all that programming and jamming it into one short phrase that sums it all up. It does not arm the word, it immediately disarms it. And this is probably one of his most devastating, the most devastating thing he's come up with. It's quite clever. It seems like it is a broken record strategy. It seems like a playground nana nana nana. It is. But this is the stuff that works. This is the stuff that gives this type of system fits and convulsions. Because you're not breaking any laws, and you're confronting some of the main levels of their programming. Not only confronting it, but you basically don't have to fight that particular phrase on the enemy's terms. You don't face a situation where you're immediately transporting an enemy back into the enemy's camp, or transporting your audience back into the enemy's camp. And that's the key thing you never want to do. You never want to transport your audience back into the enemy's camp. You want to keep them suspended, keep them with new words, new phrases, new buzzwords. You're saying the same old thing, but in a way they never heard before, and getting to the vast majority of the message that they agree with. The vast majority of white listeners automatically know that everyone agrees, all whites generally agree with some basic principles. You've got to come to what you agree with them on and not fight the social engineering. And you do that by either sidestepping it, confronting it, or basically putting things, making them come to you on your terms, doing things on your terms and not on the enemy's terms. And the last section we're going to go into is labels. I've been asked directly, what do I label myself as? There's groups that think I'm a conservative, or I'm paleo-conservative, or I'm a libertarian with some racial bents. I have others that think I'm a national socialist. I'm white with an opinion. And anyone white with an opinion is a Nazi who's going to kill 6 million Jews. Once I understood old Bob Whitaker's basic point about anyone white with an opinion is a Nazi on race and culture is a Nazi who's going to kill 6 million Jews, and without going into a broader discussion in Wordism, and if you ever read his blog, you're going to get into Wordism, that a lot of dissidents like to argue over istinisms, or the differences between paleoconservative and white nationalism. And it can be, it's so finite, it's, in some areas, it's kind of funny, but by stepping back and calling myself, whenever I'm called a particular, whenever someone says you're a white nationalist or you're a paleoconservative or any of these things, I always say the same thing. I'm white with an opinion on race and culture. Anyone white with an opinion on race and culture is a Nazi who's going to kill 6 million Jews. I say something along those lines, and I keep saying it until they understand the basic point. Now I don't have a problem with any of those labels. I've never been called liberal or a communist or anything like that. I don't have a problem with any of the particular labels, whatever they want to say. By stepping back and understanding what Bob was saying, you'll understand that you'll see a broader picture, and the vast majority of whites agree on the same thing. Yeah, the vast majority of whites agree on so much, it's kind of funny. The only thing they argue about is a lot of istinisms, and that's generally in the dissident area. The dissidents argue about these little, the minutiae, the differences between white nationalism in this part of the country and white nationalism in this country and conservatism in this part of the country and all that type of stuff. I step out of that. I stepped out of that years and years ago. By listening to Bob, I'm better off for it. At the same time, I don't run from a label. If someone wants to label me a white nationalist or paleo conservative, or I just make my point over and over again, because the enemy has drilled this stuff into people for so long that you can make a big pun out of it. Yeah, any white kid growing up in the 70s, the 80s, you know, if you have an opinion on race, they're going to immediately call you a Nazi, and it's all association, but you can do a lot of things with that. Once you step out of the box, once you start thinking out of the box, once you start stepping out of the dissident arena and get ready to talk to non-dissidents, then you can do a lot of fun and a lot of interesting things. And I'm going to cut off this particular podcast here because I don't want this section to go too long. But that is an introduction to the mantra and some different concepts in the mantra and some different things that are going on and what all the hubbub's about. Thank you for listening. We are now at the end of another episode of Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. And this podcast is, of course, all as always, dedicated to practical politics. But I'd like to take this time to thank you for tuning in and to another episode. On behalf of the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, it is yours truly, Horus the Avenger, and I'll be back with you in another episode in the near future. Until then, thank you for listening.
Remember, I'll remember your face so pale.